From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Globalization has ruled for a decade or more as the world's great answer to poverty, a way to lift the poor up while opening the world's markets to international trade. Our guest tonight, New York Times writer Tina Rosenberg, says it isn't working. It's rigged, she says, and it's failed. In this hour, addressing down and a fix for globalization. First, back at his Crawford Ranch, President Bush is taking advantage of his extended vacation to catch up on some reading. And as the debate over a U.S. attack on Iraq heats up, reporters are looking to the president's nightstand for a foreign policy clue. I spoke earlier with Washington Post White House correspondent Dana Milbank. I asked him what's at the top of the president's summer reading list.
Whatever the president's reading is always significant because it's always been a matter of some intrigue dating back, as you recall, to the campaign when he was grilled on his favorite books. And he obviously doesn't have time to do a lot of reading. The only book he mentioned reading while he's down there this month is one by a guy named Elliot Cohen, who works at Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. He's a real neoconservative hardliner, a real hawk, particularly when it comes to Iraq. And the president let it be known to the Associated Press, which had a tour of his ranch, that he is reading Elliot Cohen's book about the relationship between the president and the military during wartime.
This is the book Supreme Command.
It is indeed. Elliot told me that it gave him a small spike on Amazon.com, but in fact, his book was still ranked 5,000 something or other. So this is not exactly the Oprah book club when the president says he's reading your
Nevertheless,
book.
It's got an important audience of at least one. And as you write, this choice of a book is in the fact that the president let it slip or let it be known to the Associated Press that he's reading it plays into a larger furor or debate that's going on all the way from Washington to Waco and Crawford, I should say, where the ranch is.
Well, yeah, it certainly does. And the book itself, as Cohen insists, is really not about Iraq. He's been working on this subject for 15 years. It goes all the way back. He writes about the Civil War, the First World War. The whole idea is that you cannot leave war to the generals, that they're going to be opposed to pretty much any kind of war, and that the civilian leadership really has to take command and prod them. However, it's very convenient that this works nicely at a time when you've been hearing some of this whining coming out of the Pentagon and lots of leaks about potential strikes on Iraq, and you have a retired general, Brent Scowcroft, very close to the first President Bush, raising doubts about actions against Iraq. So essentially, you're having this grumbling from the military brass about the wisdom of an attack. So it sounds awfully nice to, you know, now the president reading a book that says, well, don't pay much attention to your generals. You know, they're always going to be whining about an attack. So
because at the end of the day, it's the political leader, it's the civilian authority in this country that's in charge.
Right. That's the theme of the book, and it fits very nicely into the current argument when the civilian leadership of the Pentagon, and it appears the president, are very eager to wage a military campaign against Saddam Hussein. So the book may not have exactly been intended to make that justification, but it fits extremely nicely in there. And one of the delicious ironies of the whole thing is the book was blurred by Bill Kristol, who's the publisher of the conservative Weekly Standard magazine, who's constantly hitting the administration for being too soft on Iraq. So and the blurbs from Kristol says, if there's one book that I could ask President Bush to read, this would be the book.
And as you note, Kristol wasn't recommending the book so Bush could have a fuller understanding of Appomattox. It's really Iraq that's the meat of this.
Yes, Kristol has shown very little interest in the president's overall intellectual development. He's merely interested in having the president endorse his hawkish line on foreign policy.
Dana Milbank, do you have a sense of how President Bush is surfing these winds of debate and disagreement over Iraq and the potential for war there? Even Brent Scowcroft, his father's close advisor, has been speaking up against it.
Right.
And you write that the informed crowd in Washington is interpreting this as Scowcroft writing what perhaps Bush the elder is simply not willing to say or even think aloud. How is this President Bush handling the back and forth?
Well, the best evidence is he's paying no attention to it whatsoever. You know, the White House and all the administration really are staying out of the debate while people like Scowcroft, while people like the European allies are sort of jumping in and raising all this host of objections. The White House is essentially saying, look, we're not going to jump in here and say, well, here's why we need to do this attack now, because they're not ready to launch such an attack. So they sort of put themselves on the sidelines. They're letting the opponents have the floor, essentially, but they're feeling like if this is the best the opponents can come up with, they can deal with these arguments later on. Now, it's pretty widely accepted and not really challenged that Scowcroft and Bush 41, the president's father, have a very similar worldview and almost certainly agree about the dangers of an attack on Iraq. Now, the former president obviously not going to say this publicly. He's not going to challenge his son publicly, and he probably, being a gentleman, does not want to meddle in the by directly bringing this up with his son. So the understanding is that Scowcroft, who obviously talks about such subjects with Bush 41, is just sort of intuitively understanding what he should be doing and has decided on his own to press ahead with this argument.
But meanwhile, in beautiful Crawford, Texas, the sitting president reads Supreme Command by Elliot Cohen, wherein he's told, don't let the generals get you down. Dana Milbank, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Globalization looks great in theory. Knock down barriers, expand the world market, grow the economies of all nations. International trade abounds, everyone benefits. But do they? Our guest tonight says she once thought that street protesters were just sentimental on globalization. But New York Times editorial writer Tina Rosenberg has tracked down the inside story of globalization, and her conclusion is the rules governing international trade are rigged in favor of the rich and the poor are losing. A decade into globalization, poor nations are poorer and rich nations are not about to change those rules. It is, says Rosenberg, a rigged game. Tonight on Point, globalization gets a mainstream roughing up. If globalization is pushing poor countries backwards, what do we do about it? Can we have cheap running shoes and a fair shake for the third world? Can global trade be reformed to serve the poor and the wealthy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Mexico City is Tina Rosenberg, editorial writer for the New York Times and author of the article in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, The Free Trade Fix. Good evening and welcome, Tina Rosenberg.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Tina.
Hi, Jack. It's been a long time.
It sure has. Great to have you on the program.
Thanks.
Tina Rosenberg, we are used to hearing people scream down globalization from the streets whenever the IMF or other world economic bodies get together. We're not so accustomed to seeing it slapped down with quite the clarity, the black and white clarity that you did in the New York Times last week. And it was a terrific article. But we're used to something more like a, on the one hand, on the other hand, critique of globalization. You've come right out and said, hey, forget it. It's rigged. It's failing. It's not working. What's the evidence?
Well, on the one hand...
Now, don't get started with that.
No, I'm joking. I think you overstated my conclusion a little bit. It is rigged. It is working more for rich countries than poor countries. I wouldn't say it's pushing poor countries back into poverty. I think the jury is out on what the effect has been. What we can certainly say is that it hasn't lived up to its promise at all for most poor countries. And the ones that have been able to take advantage of it have done so by violating all the rules that the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund have set down.
Now, I hear you qualifying, but the article is pretty upfront saying this is rigged. Here's how it's rigged. It can't be free trade if you've got a 22,000-page WTO, World Trade Organization, agreement governing it. And you cite examples of countries who have tried to play by the rules and lost ground. You warn that globalization is producing such inequities that we risk seeing the whole system fall apart, countries pulling back. What's the most compelling evidence to you that it's not living up to its billing?
Well, I think you have to look at the growth rates. There are very, very few countries that have been able to grow using the rules of globalization. There's a couple who have, and I talk at length about Chile, which is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, Latin America, which is where I live and which is the poor continent that has taken globalization the furthest, has done the most to follow the rules. And growth rates have been very disappointing. I think a lot of people are now starting to vote for populist anti-globalization candidates again because they're saying, what is this getting us?
You say that in its way, globalization has proved to be no less polarizing than the Cold War divisions it has supplanted. Where do you see that? Are we talking there about protesters outside and power brokers inside, or are these lines going right down through countries and continents?
Well, it's both. I mean, it's first of all between the developed world and the developing world, where people feel a lot more skeptical about it. But it's also in these developing countries, because there have been many very powerful groups of people in poor countries that have done quite well by globalization, just like here in the United States.
Tina Rosenberg, you've been in Latin America a long time, and you write that you didn't start out necessarily as such a skeptic of globalization because, in part, you had seen for many years before this great wave came into effect how old closed economies were dominated by local aristocrats and industrialists. It's not going back that you're advocating here. What is it?
Well, I mean, what we need here is a system that is almost impossible to achieve because it wouldn't have the usual rules of politics in it. And the problem with closed economies is that theoretically governments can use them to help the poor, but they don't. I mean, they don't spend their health budget on rural health clinics. They spend it on big urban hospitals to help the middle class.
And closed economies are what preceded the globalization wave.
That's right. I mean, the governments are subject to pressures from powerful people in their society. They're subject to corruption. They're subject to pressures from people who have the money and the organization to protest, etc. Now, if globalization could solve that problem, I'd be all for it. And in fact, some of its supporters bill it that way. They're saying, look, the market punishes corruption. The market will punish these irrational kinds of ways of allocating your dollars. And if that's truly what were happening, then that would be good for the poor all over the world. That's not what's happening at all. What's happened is that the rules of globalization have been drawn up disproportionately by wealthy countries, and within those wealthy countries by certain groups. For example, in the United States, the pharmaceutical industry, the software industry, financial services, and agribusiness especially, those are businesses that have benefited disproportionately from globalization.
And it's not that you're opposed to free trade. You're saying ultimately it is essential. Globalization itself, you say, is ultimately essential for the poor.
That's right. No country has ever developed over the long term without trading, without economic integration. You cannot close your doors on the world and pretend to be self-sufficient. It doesn't work. But what I'm arguing for is a system that would give countries more flexibility to develop in the way that they want to, rather than having to follow a set of rules that are really laid down by a group of people in countries that do not have the best interests of the poor in mind.
Jack Beatty, here's the New York Times Sunday Magazine with a black and white cover and something close to a black and white thesis when it comes to globalization. Yes, countries need it, but no, it's not set up right. It's not working. It's rigged.
Yes, and her proposals for changing it are exactly what the doctor ordered. I mean, all of these would both maintain economic dynamism and reinforce equity. That's the problem with globalization. There's been a huge trade-off of equity for efficiency, and at a certain point, societies won't pay the price unless they get the benefits. Hence, you are getting these populist candidates in Europe and Latin America who are saying, stop the music. We're not benefiting from this. Why should we continue to sacrifice our standard of living on the altar of this theory? And there's no good answer for that unless this program, this revolution is made to work for ordinary people. And it hasn't happened thus far. And if it doesn't, the reaction against it will be populist regimes that will institute protectionism. There'll be, you know, autarkic economies, which will be bad for the people who live there. And we might even have a kind of beguile thy neighbor trading system again. So a lot depends on widening the beneficiary range here of globalization.
It's happened before. Tina Rosenberg writes that globalization has had previous high tides and then fell back. Will it happen again? Do you agree that the new world order, the globalized economic system, is somehow out of whack? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the rigging of globalization with New York Times writer Tina Rosenberg. Is globalization a great idea that's become a thinly disguised power play by rich countries? Can we re-examine globalization without sliding back into closed economies and stunted trade? And if your Nikes are cheap enough, do you give a damn about who's making them and where? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us. Tina Rosenberg, you write that it is often said, has been said many times in the last decade, that globalization is a kind of force of nature, which describes it or portrays it as somehow an inevitable wave. You say that is untrue and misleading. How so?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not irreversible. We did have globalization at the turn of the last century. In fact, in some ways, the world was more globalized than it is now because you not only had the free movement of capital, you had the free movement of labor. And that's the one thing poor countries can export in great quantity. That got stopped by World War I, and then sort of the last shot in the heart was the Depression. So it you know, what we have now could turn around again. More importantly, however, globalization supporters portray it as if it were a peeling away of distortions to reveal this elegant system of free international commerce, you know, the one that nature wanted for us. Mm-hmm. And it's not that at all. I mean, as you mentioned before, the accord that creates the World Trade Organization is more than 22,000 pages long.
Well, get into that with us. You talk about how the system is rigged. Give us some examples,
okay.
Because I think people hear globalization. We understand it at a high economic, mm-hmm. conceptual level. This ought to be good. What's the rigged factor here?
Okay. For example, virtually every single wealthy country and all of those in East Asia that are now moderately wealthy, like Korea, Malaysia, et cetera, globalized and traded, but did so under a set of rules that are now prohibited by the World Trade Organization rules and by what the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, tells.
So you're saying the path that Japan and Korea, Singapore and Taiwan took is closed?
You can't do it anymore. For example, what Korea did was decide it wanted to build a domestic electronics industry that could export to the world. And it told General Motors, for example, you can come in and invest, but as a requirement for doing so, you have to help our industries learn how to do the same things you do. And so GM did, and that's how Korea's electronics and car industry got built. You can't do that anymore. Those kinds of local content rules that, you know, your products have to be some produced locally, or technology transfer rules, are illegal.
Is that what you mean by rigged?
That's one way it's rigged. There's lots of ways. Another example is the rules on intellectual property, which I think is extremely important. What that means is that countries that join the World Trade Organization have to, by the year 2005, agree to respect patents on, most importantly, medicine.
That sounds reasonable on the surface.
Well, it does sound reasonable on the surface, except the problem is that these countries have been able to protect their public health by making generic copies of drugs that are still under patent in the developed world. And this debate has burst into the open over AIDS. AIDS is now a disease of poor countries, and yet poor countries can absolutely not afford to pay American or European prices for medicines. And to require them to do so is going to literally consign tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people to death. This provision of the World Trade Organization rules is not one that a lot of people think is really, really should be in there. It's in there because the pharmaceutical industry and the software industry are tremendously influential in Washington and with the Washington group who negotiates these trade agreements, and they were able to get Washington to force other countries to keep these rules in. This is a rule that is going to be absolutely terrible for most of the people in the world.
Jack Beatty, it sounds like the X factor here may have something to do with the pragmatic understanding on the ground of how these economies work, how nations work. It's fine to say free trade lifts all boats, but then Tina Rosenberg points out that, in fact, East Asian nations who made such strides in recent decades did it behind protective walls. Intellectual property sounds great, but if people are dying of AIDS by the millions, it's hard to build an economy.
It sure is. And, of course, our economy is the greatest success in the world behind protectionist walls. In the 1880s, you had to swear an oath at the University of Pennsylvania never to teach free trade. Protection was so it was so necessary to American prosperity. So we have kicked away the ladder. And in the name of an ideology, you know, a theory about the way things ought to be, held, you know, without evidential regard for the way things are or ever were. But this relationship that Tina was talking about between this theory and human cruelty really has a precedent, and that is Ireland. In the Irish famine is often thought of as a natural phenomenon, the potato blight and so on. Mm. Well, it was a natural phenomenon with enabled by the ideology of free trade. The British government under Sir Robert Peel suspended the Corn Laws and embarked on an experiment in free trade, and Ireland was the first victim, such that at the height of the famine, when Irish women's bodies were swollen from hunger, when children were weeping for food, the Irish were obliged, under the rules of trade, after all, comparative advantage, they were obliged to export their corn to Britain. And Britain would not intervene, because to do that would be break the symmetry of the laws of trade. And when people would say, but there's the humanitarian disaster, they would say, yes, but you know, this theory says that in time things will shake out and you'll have a more provident people in Ireland. Mm. No one of Irish descent can believe in the ideology of free trade.
Tina Rosenberg, would you go that far? I mean, free trade also builds countries up, or so we're told.
I'm not of Irish descent. I would not go quite as far as Jack on free trade. But what we're talking about isn't free trade.
That's the point you make. And I guess the question there that I come away with is this somehow malicious? Is this a deliberate scam? You write that when you began to look into this, you were perplexed. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are perplexed, because on the one hand, what Jack calls an ideology, or at least the concept, sounds right. Free trade ought to build up a global economy. So if it's being tinkered with, if it's being rigged and fixed, who's doing that? Does someone want these countries not to get ahead?
No, it's not. There's no conspiracy here in that classic sense. But let me use the example of corn as an illustrator.
Okay.
We have in the United States had a series of farm laws, farm bills and farm laws, that provide huge subsidies to large scale American producers. And let's not confuse this with helping the family farms. This is going to the Archer Daniels Midland and the Cargills, et cetera. Mm. And what it is doing is making American corn extremely cheap to export. And when we negotiated the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico, Mexico said, okay, corn is really important to Mexico. I mean, it's the symbol of our nation. It's our daily bread. And we don't want to be flooded with cheap American corn right away. Mm-hmm. So they had a certain amount of time, 15 years, to keep out gradually, to gradually let in more and more American corn, in part to help their own chicken and pork industry. Mm-hmm. Some powerful producers, and including one who sat on the Mexico NAFTA negotiating team, they lifted those quotas right away. So all of a sudden, very cheap American corn came flooding into Mexico. That has absolutely devastated poor corn farmers. And that's a large percentage of poor Mexicans. Mm. Americans tend to believe the rhetoric that we hear from our congressmen and senators and from the administration, that it's great that we are flooding the world with cheap food. But that's not true, in fact, because the problem is not that there's not enough food in the world. The problem is that the people who are poor can't buy it. And three-quarters of the world's poor are rural poor, and most of those people are trying to eke out a living by growing and selling corn and rice, et cetera, themselves. And their markets have been wiped out.
So you're saying it's not malicious, but it's just the power of the richer countries asserting itself through what's now a global system, which can be a global conduit for that power.
And these farm bills come about because politicians have to be able to tell their constituents, I'm creating new markets for American products overseas, which sounds great. And it's great for the people, the agribusiness, who can benefit from it. Hmm. But we're not thinking about the consequences.
Listeners,
if you go to the hills of Puebla, where I spent some time, it's one of the states in the central to the south of Mexico, and you meet corn farmers who are as poor as can be, who are suddenly getting half the price for their corn that they used to be, and they can't live anymore. They're literally losing money on every hectare they produce.
Let's turn to our callers. If this is free trade, why do we need 22,000 pages of loopholes and privileges? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Seth is on the line. Hi, Seth. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about growth, capitalism, and globalization.
Fire away.
I've read an article just a couple weeks ago talking about the fact that for a capital country for it to grow, mm-hmm. it needs to keep growing.
Sure.
And that's a fuel for
prosperity.
Exactly. And so in a system where you have countries of different sizes, for a country that is larger to grow, how can that work when you're trying to focus on helping the third world countries grow?
Well, it's the old zero-sum question. And Seth, let's put it right to Tina Rosenberg. I mean, Tina, the theory is that all countries grow together when trade increases. Seth is asking if somehow each country has to grow at the expense of another. You're suggesting that that is, in fact, what's happening to some degree here, but it doesn't have to be that way.
No, it doesn't. I think the whole theory of free trade to begin with, which I think is correct, is that growth does not have to be a zero-sum game. You don't have to have a winner and a loser. Everybody benefits. It is interesting that I'm not certain I understand the point he's raising, but for example, you have China and India, mm-hmm. which together make up the bulk of the world's poor, growing fairly well, China phenomenally and India moderately over the last few years. Now, there is a serious argument about whether free trade is to benefit, is what you can attribute this to, because both of them have done so in complete defiance of all the rules.
China's been behind all kinds of barriers, and so was India for many years.
Yeah. But this is the example of how poor countries can help their poor. China has lifted probably 200 million people out of poverty over the last 15 or 20 years by growing.
So it's trade, but not necessarily free trade. Tina Rosenberg, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Daniel Yergin. He's executive producer of the PBS series Commanding Heights, The Battle for the World Economy. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Yergin.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. Daniel Yergin, you've been listening to this conversation. You no doubt saw Tina Rosenberg's large piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine asserting that globalization is a rigged, a fixed system, and it's failing.
Well, I'm not sure that it says it's failing. I thought that she had a lot of very good and sensible points in there going against some of the opinions that float around. I mean, people rail against globalization, this abstract five-syllable word, mm-hmm. you know, what does it mean? Are we against the fact that public radio shows can be, you know, from the United States can be heard in Finland and Kazakhstan? I mean, that's globalization. Clearly, what the focus here is about trade and investment. And I've thought this is discussion's made a lot of good points, but I think it's left out some really big things.
Well, we are deliberately focusing on the economic face of globalization.
No, exactly.
I know it's all tied in together here.
And I think left out really big things on the economic. I think that a lot of this, you know, discussion I've listened to, some of it has been quite, you know, has lost sight of the history. I mean, if you take East Asia, what the difference of East Asia compared to the traditional developing countries, as Tina talks about in an article, which were closed, said, well, we're going to cast our fate with the world economy. That was in the 70s and 80s.
But, of course, they did do that from behind all kinds of trade barriers, trade barriers that the United States was arguing over with Japan to this very day.
Well, they did do it, but they did it in quite a difference from what was the traditional go-it-alone strategy. Singapore was so poor when it became independent that people didn't think it was going to make it as a country.
But isn't the whole point here?
Singapore today has a higher standard of living than the UK.
But Daniel Yergin, isn't the whole point here that they did it in a way by keeping their borders closed to an awful lot of imports while they exported exactly the thing that the IMF and the new globalization regime says is a no-no?
I think the discussion about the IMF, you've given it way too much power. The IMF is basically focused on when countries get into really hot water – as you know, in the commanding heights, we had Stanley Fischer, who had been number two at the IMF, saying, you know, we're called in when the country is in serious problem because their debt has gone way, they can't support their currency, the debt has gone crazy, and it's acute problems that. So I think that part of the discussion, Tina talks in her article about the problems that exist within these countries. For instance, you know, getting the infrastructure right in terms of private property and education and in health.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the discussion on the World Trade Organization is out of date by 8 months.
How so?
Because the last meeting of the World Trade Organization was in Doha, and the whole focus of the world trade now is the development agenda, which is to get a trading regime in place that focuses for the developing countries.
Tina Rosenberg, I remember
hearing the finance minister of South Africa, somebody who had led in the independence struggle and the battle against apartheid, saying last year, who are these people who tell us we can't have trade and investment? And the two biggest problem is, I mean, one of the problems is, of course, textiles, and the other is agriculture. This discussion is sort of blamed the U.S., but I'll tell you, the biggest problem is Europe. They're the biggest protectionist.
The U.S. is closest to home, but Tina Rosenberg puts it in terms of the wealthiest countries. But Tina Rosenberg, do you buy that this critique of the shortcomings of globalization is 8 months or a year old, that it's actually the ship is turning and it's all about development now?
Things are changing very, very, very slowly and in a limited way, in part because of the recognition by the IMF after the Asia crisis in 1997 that they were not helpful and probably helped to cause it in some ways.
No, I don't think that's true, Tina.
In part because the poor countries are beginning to assert themselves, and in part because, frankly, the rich countries are getting scared. I mean, we're starting to see a backlash.
All right.
But let me dispute what Daniel Yergin said on two points. Mm. One is the power of the IMF. It's true, they come in when a country's in serious trouble, but then they don't go away. I mean, a third of the developing world is in some IMF lending program right now, and some of these countries have been there for decades, and they have to keep reforming their economies along IMF lines. Now, I think Mr. Yergin's right in saying that there has been some recognition that the rules have lacked flexibility and that there needs to be a less sort of one-size-fits-all prescription. But it's on the margins.
Mm-hmm. And you note, Tina Rosenberg, that President Bush's new fast-track power is, in your view, another way of contravening free markets.
Well, what Congress just passed was a law that gives the president the authority to negotiate new trade deals. And Congress has given up its ability to say anything about it except yes or no at the end. It's basically giving him a negotiating tool.
What's wrong with that?
In theory, nothing. But if you look at what these laws contain, the problem is some of these bills are so complex and so arcane that not only does the American public not know what's in them, but congressmen don't even know what's in them. Let me just give you one example that I think would outrage the American people.
Tina, please hold that example because we've got to take a short break.
Okay.
We're talking tonight with Tina Rosenberg, New York Times, and Daniel Yergin, executive producer of the PBS series Commanding Heights. We'll be right back. We're talking about the rigging of globalization. Is globalization a great idea that's become a thinly disguised power play for rich countries? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the rigging of globalization. I guess the question is, do you agree that the new world order, the globalized economic system, is somehow out of whack? Can we re-examine globalization without sliding back into closed economies and stunted trade? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Daniel Yergin. He's executive producer of the PBS series Commanding Heights, The Battle for the World Economy, and by New York Times writer Tina Rosenberg. And Tina, I had to interrupt you just before the break, but you were talking about an example of congressional action out of this most recent round of trade legislation that people might not be aware of.
Yeah, it's called, it has the very innocuous sounding name of Chapter 11, which makes it sound like some benign bankruptcy thing. Hmm. It's in NAFTA. It's in the North American Free Trade Agreement, and now it's in the draft of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which Washington is now negotiating. It's basically going to try to extend NAFTA to all of Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what it does. It allows any company which has the value of its investment diminished by some government action to sue that government in a special secret trade court. And I'll give you an example. You can right now it's being used in against Mexico, the United States, and Canada because it's part of NAFTA. And a Canadian company that claims to own American producers of a certain gasoline additive called Methanex is suing California for nearly $1 billion. And the reason is that California, like a dozen other states, is phasing out Methanex in its gasoline because it's found to have been contaminating water wells throughout the state, and it's been found to be carcinogenic. This is a perfectly reasonable environmental regulation. But this Canadian company is saying this is tantamount to expropriation. It's like a government coming in and expropriating us. And these trade courts have found, in some cases, for the companies. And these rules, first of all, are being used to help polluters. You're paying the polluters, basically. And they're being used as a scare tactic to discourage countries from passing environmental laws. Now, can you imagine what's going to happen when you have Ecuador and Bolivia and a lot of very poor countries in Latin America who are going to have to contend with this? I mean, whatever little environmental legislation they have is going to be devastated.
Daniel Yergin, how does a story like that, and I guess this general critique, square with your view of the progress of globalization and maybe even what did go on in Doha?
Well, I think world trade doubled in the 1990s. And, you know, millions of new jobs around the world, millions and millions were created. I mean, for instance, the Indian, Tina's colleague Tom Friedman wrote about how important the Indian high-tech industry and software industry
Huge.
Was in not only large, but how critical that industry was to helping prevent India from going to war with Pakistan. At least Tom wrote that.
So the promise of globalization, knitting the world together, is working in that way.
I mean, there are huge problems, and there are trade-offs that for a developing country wants to increase exports of textiles, well, that impacts North Carolina and jobs there. So there are going to be trade-offs. But I'm struck that Roberto Lagos, who's the president of Chile, who was imprisoned by Pinochet, has been saying for several years now, you know, why can't we want to have a free trade agreement. We want to be part of NAFTA. So there are these problems that Tina talks about that need to be addressed. But the larger thing is that countries generally see it as beneficial. They don't want to be kept in a sort of, you know, as a poor country. The whole question here is about, you know, the only way to get people out of poverty is through economic growth. I mean, you don't get them out of poverty with fine words and great rhetoric. And, you know, it seems to be the way to do it is to be part of the world economy.
But is it producing that growth? Tina Rosenberg looks at the record and says this is not sufficient.
Chile is an exception. Chile has been able to use trade to grow. And they have done so because they have certain advantages that other countries don't have, in the sense of they have historically had a very efficient state. This has nothing to do with Pinochet. Chile's always been like this. And they have taken steps to protect the poor and keep them from being hurt.
Lagos talks about how opening up to the world economy and the reform they went through prepared them to for an era of globalization. It's true. You look at Argentina. It's very interesting to contrast the two.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Argentina in such hot water now? Well, it got into such hot water in part because it managed to run up $142 billion of debt very quickly. What did it do? It paid state legislators $300,000 a year. Even Massachusetts doesn't pay state legislators $300,000 a year. Well, you run up a debt like that, you create, you know, corruption, all of those problems. You're not reforming. You're connecting with the world economy, but only partly.
Tina Rosenberg, is Daniel Yergin blaming the victim here, or do the countries that haven't succeeded yet under globalization just need to pull up their socks and get their houses in order?
Well, it's both. I mean, it's true that globalization will only work for you if you meet a lot of different requirements. For example, you have to have this efficient state. You have to be a country that emphasizes education. But the point that I'm making in the article is that if you are a badly run and corrupt closed economy, becoming a badly run and corrupt open economy is not going to get you anywhere. Globalization is not the answer to your problems, and it's not even a phenomenon that's going to push you in the direction.
But Tina, do you think that if countries run up enormous deficits and just keep spending and spending and borrowing and destroying their currency in the process, that that's going to be a solution for poverty and growth?
Of course I don't think that. I mean, there's no more than 100%, and everyone has to recognize that. But the rules are so are so obsessed with the idea of controlling inflation, which is what you're talking about. I mean, the problem with huge deficits is that one of the big problems.
Well, remember
is that it
Argentina.
Inflation.
Argentina had a 20,000% inflation. Can we imagine living with that? I mean, hyperinflation. You quote Jeff Sachs. Jeff would say that was you couldn't do anything until you dealt with hyperinflation, because it just, money means nothing.
I agree with that. You have to deal with it. But the IMF is so obsessed with inflation that it even told the Clinton administration, look, you've got to contract the economy.
The IMF did even worse. They warned that the U.S. had a bubble economy. Can you imagine that they did that?
Daniel Juergen, I know we've got to let you go. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. All right, well, stay with us then. I want to let our callers in. George is on the line. Welcome, George. You're on the air.
Yeah, how are you?
Well, thanks.
My question is that when we usually discuss issues of a free market, we look only at one side of the question, the rich countries helping the poor kind of thing.
What's your view, George?
We don't never look at the governments of these poor countries and the responsibilities on integrating on the free market.
So do you think globalization is helping or hurting in terms of making governments accountable and bringing growth?
Absolutely, it's helping a lot. Like Peru, I'm from Peru, and it was a closed economy. Now that it's an open economy, the country has progressed. Because now, you have access to bigger markets.
Jack Beatty, how about this point that it's not about globalization? It's about crummy governments at home not doing their job. And our caller George says globalization puts the pressure on them to shape up.
Well, this is one of the things that advocates say about it, and here's a case of where it seems to be working. When I said earlier I don't believe in it, I meant I don't believe in it as a dogma. You show me the evidence, and I'm willing to say it works. The trouble here is the way we have approached this thing. We are exporting through the IMF and the WTO a kind of capitalism that we do not have in our own country. In our own country, we have minimum wages. We have labor laws. You can organize. There are fire safety.
There's nothing in the IMF or the WTO that prevents labor organization, if any, or the World Bank. In fact, they're all out there encouraging it. One of the big things is that these countries need social safety nets. They don't have them.
Are you telling me the AFL-CIO is wrong when it objected to NAFTA on precisely these grounds?
Read Tina's article about the value that NAFTA, in terms of higher standards of living. We interviewed people in the Commanding Heights who had no jobs, couldn't feed their children, who migrated to the north of Mexico, and they're not jobs working on Route 128. Let's be honest about that. But they're able to support and feed their children.
Let's put it to Tina Rosenberg. Tina, you spend a lot of time in Latin America. Do you see the overall effect of globalization raising up working standards of the kind that Jack's talking about here?
On the one hand, yes and no. I mean, you have winners and losers. I think someone who is starving to death on a farm, who suddenly has the opportunity to go, let's be honest, be totally exploited in a factory gluing tennis shoes or making computer keyboards, and takes that job, does so because he obviously feels that it's a better choice than what he had before. I mean, I feel like you need to have labor standards, you need to have protections for workers, but those people are not the losers from globalization. They are part of the winners.
Because they've got a job and a wage.
The ones who have to now leave their farms because they can't sell their corn anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's shocking to think 90% of the TVs in America now actually come from Mexico. And again, we filmed in some of those factories. Now, some of them will have deplorable conditions. Some of them are, as Tina describes, very modern.
But she also describes them, Daniel Juergen, as places of manufacture where the technology flows right through and may still or may soon be in China, leaving them without the long-term benefit. I want to try and get more calls in. John's on the line from San Francisco. Good evening, John. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Thank you. This is kind of a bit off the subject, more towards a – well, I thought it was a great article, but I don't think I'd be out of line in saying that the New York Times – previous take on globalization tends to be pretty endorses it in a way that would make both the IMF or the World Bank fairly happy.
Tina's piece was striking in the way that it said, wait a minute, wasn't it?
Yeah, and particularly if you look at the op-ed pages where folks like Paul Krugman and Thomas Friedman, people I respect, were fairly condescending towards those who question globalization in its present form.
What does that lead you to, John?
Well, actually, I turn the question to Tina if she thinks that this will signal a change within New York Times to represent voices which are not exactly what you would hear more voices like Noam Chomsky or more voices like folks from Global Exchange.
John, I think we've got the question, John. Tina Rosenberg, how about it? Do you represent a sea change?
I would not venture an opinion on that. I think that you are seeing a little bit of change. There was a column by Paul Krugman last week talking about how perhaps globalization isn't working in Latin America. What he's reacting to are the wave of contagion crises of Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay. He's certainly not reacting to anything I'm writing. But there are different voices on the op-ed page and throughout the paper. Mine is one of them.
Daniel Yergin, I want to get a last comment from you to this point that world trade agreements are tilted in favor of the powerful, that poor nations are left at the bar outside while decisions get made in the smoky room, and it's just not a level playing field. It's not free trade.
I think that's out of date. I think there are 142 nations. I think countries like India and China are going to make their weight felt, and I think that the thrust from Doha, which was in the shadow of 9/11, is towards a development agenda for trade. As Tina says, it's not going to happen overnight. There are enormous interests in all countries involved, and I think the process of negotiation will take 5 or 6 years. But I think it's going to be focused on integrating it, and that part of the way globalization will be judged, indeed, is what does it mean for global poverty.
There's a more optimistic view. Daniel Yergin, thank you for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Daniel Yergin is executive producer of the PBS series Commanding Heights, The Battle for the World Economy. Tina Rosenberg, are you equally sanguine?
No. Because I think that some of these rules are now fixed. I think that you are not going to be able to really diminish the influence of special interests in these things. The development round that Mr. Yergin keeps referring to, mm-hmm. I have yet to see much evidence that it is serious. Yes, the U.S. has been making points about agriculture, but they're generally asking for changes that America doesn't have to do, Europe would have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that there is a growing realization that globalization has failed much of the world's poor, but I'm not all that particularly optimistic that it's going to change anytime soon.
Tina Rosenberg, it was a brave and bracing article that you wrote, and we thank you for writing it and for joining us tonight. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, there it is. Daniel Yergin to the defense. Tina Rosenberg making her tour of Latin America and elsewhere and saying, boy, I see some trouble out here.
Yeah, she's been on the ground. She sees this. And, you know, what makes me hopeful, articles like hers, books like the Joseph Stiglitz book, Globalization and Its Discontent, which blows the whistle on the IMF and which would ruffle the complacency of Mr. Yergin.
This is Joseph Stiglitz.
That's right, a Nobel Prize winning economist who worked for the IMF. This is very important. There's a new mood to reform globalization and to say globalization for whom? And Tina is clear here. Thus far, it's been globalization for the powerful countries and within those countries for big agribusiness, for the drug companies, for, financial services companies.
Well, here's
make
to,
it work for everybody.
Yeah, here's to aggressively making it work. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.